What about Beauty and the Beast? Well, I think from all that I've said, that Beauty and the Beast refers to the beauty of that queen of existence, woman, the essential woman, and the beast that tries to destroy her, possess her, and drag her down to his own level, which of course is sex. And it's not only man that's ravaged now by sex, that is obsessed by sex and excitement. Of course, many women are obsessed by excitement because man has induced it into her. So I can't really blame man for that, although he was originally to blame for it. Because woman, once she gets hooked on excitement, becomes a slave to it. And she is not likely to hear what I'm saying because it would mean the death of her excitement. And that would be like a living death to her. It would be like giving up a favorite food. You know how difficult that is. It's hard enough to give up a favorite food where you know that the next meal you're not going to get it ever again. Oh, I've got nothing to look forward to. Oh, dear. Well, it's 1,000 times worse when a woman who's hooked on sexual excitement starts to give it up. But she has to be very perceptive to do that. She has to have suffered enough and be able to see, I do not want this anymore. Until she sees that, she'll have to suffer and keep suffering and making the best of it. Oh, it's all right. She'll have to get into the office and work very hard to work it off as much as she can. She'll have to do so many things to replace her need of love, or try to replace it. She'll have to keep very busy, in other words. The problem that we as men and women face is this materialism that has developed more and more in our society. It is due to scientific thought. We all think like the scientist does. We're all looking for the solution outside, like the scientist looks into the atom, then looks into some particle that he's invented in his mind, but is still external to him. We do the same in looking for a solution to our love life outside of us. So this has given rise to a materialism which thinks that the solution to our problems is outside, when it's clearly not. For if the solution to our problems was in science or outside, then it would have been solved a long, long time ago. But it gets worse, doesn't it? The muggings, the beatings, the random violence, the sexual abuse, all the sexuality coming out of the woodwork now, and justifying sexual acts with children, which will get worse and worse. And they will be justified more and more. And they'll reduce the age of consent because of pressure groups of homosexuals. They'll reduce the age of consent. Things will get worse and worse. And the younger ones who are got at early will turn to homosexuality or something else and give up love, as I've been describing it, between man and woman. That will all go. That's already on the way out. For love between man and woman is the rarest thing on this earth. It is now a sort of compatibility. You do your thing, I'll do my thing. I'll masturbate if I haven't got you. I'll just masturbate, and then I'll do my best if you come. I'll masturbate in you, and I'll get you to masturbate and excite you. And so love is just disappearing between man and woman. Terrible thing, because the children are going to inherit the current notions of what is love and freedom. Children are going to inherit that. And it's going into the psyche, you see. We're psychic creatures more than physical ones. And it is the psyche that influences our behavior. And everything that man and woman do goes into the psyche as an energy, as a vital energy. And there, it goes through the psyche, which is limitless, and then reappears in the next generations. And so it is said that the sins of the fathers and mothers will fall upon the sons and daughters unto the fifth and sixth generations. And that's a long time, because by then they're changed into that. Those sins, as they said in the Old Testament. There is not a very hopeful picture of the future on this earth. But then the wonderful thing is, there's such a thing as death. And nobody lives beyond 70 or 80 years, let's say. And then, at the moment of death, everything disappears. Everything. So really, the whole of existence disappears. So nothing's been lost. Nothing. And we've made such a misery of it and missed the beauty of it so much. But it doesn't matter, because death takes it all anyway. And then we enter another state of consciousness which is not describable, but certainly is demonstrable in the truth that I speak and my authority and my love. What can I do, I'm often asked, as a woman with a family? Well, the first thing that I advise the man and the woman, and particularly the woman, is when they have the child, in the first instance, is to speak to the child immediately it's born, and not think rationally like the scientists, that something is not going into that child. To tell them, for instance, when the babe's just in the arms, in the bed beside you, on your breast, this is a strange world that you have entered. You have come out of a place of self-sufficiency, of warmth, no space, where you didn't have to eat, where you didn't have to breathe. And in this strange world, there is breathing, there is distance, there is heat and cold, which you are only now registering, starting to register. But I tell you that there is a place in this strange existence where you can return. Over the years, you can return to that place of peace and stillness and fulfillment. And I will do all I can to help you to reach that place. Now, a child's got to be spoken to through its various ages about the truth of life. Not the truth of what we think life is, but the truth of life. This is a very strange existence. And it is a great shock to be born into it. And it's a lasting shock. And every one of us, in those early days, needs the comfort of being told what it is, where they are, the comfort of our arms around the bodies, the warmth of love. And so from the husband too, the father too, he needs to be able to speak, for he has things to say to the child which the woman doesn't have about the truth of existence. But this does require them both to have lived a spiritual life where they know something about the truth of existence and not the truth or the so-called truth or theories that the scientists propose. You can leave that to the schools and the society to teach the child. Better to open them to know more about the world from which they just came and which they eventually, in death, will return to anyway. So the parents, it's very important for the parents to give the example to the children as they grow up of not arguing as much as possible, although we can't live ideals, to find out what the cause of the discrepancy is, and to address the cause and not the effect, which is the argument. For we usually address the effects. You said this, I said that, you accuse me of that, and all it goes on and whereas the cause of the argument is something deeper between us, which we are not facing, and we should address that. And we should show the children, as they are able to comprehend, how we address our problems straightly, directly, honestly, instead of the usual cover-ups that we see in the families around us and pretense of love. Woman must not be just a mother. She must first be a lover. In other words, she must put her man that she lives with, that is her partner, she must put him before the children. The reason for that is that that's how they started out. There was only the man and woman. And their love is precious. And if they fall out of love, or start to fall out of love, or become used to each other or familiar, then that will affect the upbringing of the child. It must be remembered that man and woman, their love comes first. If not, the child will start to, at times, play one against the other. The child is not a stupid thing. It is a very intelligent being, and it responds to the environment and what it sees around it. And the man and woman should aim to be a partnership, and they'll never be a partnership unless they put their love first. If they start loving each other through the child, then that's disaster, and you sink into the condition of human love which you see in so many families on this earth. To keep their love alive, to keep love alive in the house, the man and woman must continue to make love. Without the making of love, man and woman always drift apart. They have this psychological drift. They can live together, indeed. But it is the psychological drift that counts, the distance that comes between them psychologically. And eventually they have to learn to make love without wanting to or not wanting to. For when you make love often, just by making love, because you naturally came together to make love, then you continue to make love as often as possible. That is the way you get rid of wanting to make love or not wanting to make love. In other words, likes and dislikes about love. Then you don't get the woman saying, I've got a headache or I don't feel like it. You don't get the man lying there unable to bring himself to make the love because something inside him can't be bothered. Because if you make love morning and night, there's no choice in it, because you will find that you love making love. And you overcome the self that from time to time doesn't want to make love. It does that deliberately so that it gets a sense of self. There's nothing right or holy about it. It's not a matter of yourself in the sense that it's in a condition that it's not right to make love. That's not true. The idea is to get rid of the self out of lovemaking, so that there's no choice, that it is just, because lovemaking between man and woman is just beautiful. Why else does man pursue woman? In his mind or in his body, never stops thinking about her, never stops pursuing her. She must be beautiful to him. She must. And something must have come between them. Something. Now, what is it? But in our society, we're so stupid and ignorant that we haven't paused to say, what has come between us? We've heard it on the movies. We heard it in real life. What has happened to us? What have we lost? How have we lost it? How did we ever go wrong? Well, I tell you how you go wrong. You go wrong through familiarity. When you live together, the normal thing is to gradually become familiar with each other, to take each other for granted, and the lovemaking will fall off. Instead of making love as you did when you first came together, every day or twice a day, it starts to become two or three times a week. Then it starts to become once a month. And then one or the other can't be bothered or not moved to. That's a terrible state of affairs. Because love has gone out the window. And comfort and convenience and selfish likes and dislikes have come in. Now, the idea of love is to live a vital life. I mean, when you're not making love, life should be vital inside of you. That means alive. Life is vital inside. And through the senses, you see everything that's going on, but life is vital inside. And one of the most vital things on earth is the making of love between man and woman. That's why they're both so interested in it and obsessed by it. And they allow this familiarity to come between them. Now, I tell the people, I say now, a honeymoon should not last 3 weeks. Well, that's a device that this society has invented so that you can get back to ordinariness, so you can get back to work, so you can get back to arguing, discussing, having likes and dislikes together. That's what that's invented for. The honeymoon should never end. Now, that sounds a bit ideal in this society, but not if you start first things first. And first things first is never to stop making love. Often. Then you don't have to depend on feeling like it or not feeling like it, because it's always beautiful. The only thing that interferes is if I want to or don't want to. That's what interferes. The self comes into it. And that self between couples usually arises in the first 3 weeks or 4 weeks, something like that, where one, let's take the man, is likely to say a deprecating word about the woman partner. In other words, he says an undermining word, such as he might say, yes, well, you've made a mistake in this letter, haven't you? You never were much good, were you, at writing letters or spelling? Now, if anything like that is ever said, that is an emotional statement aimed at undermining the woman. Or if she says to him, she says something equivalent, which threatens his manhood or something, where she might say something about a previous lover, which makes him feel that he's not up to it or something in just the slightest way. She might joke about it, but it penetrates him. And there becomes an emotion in him, and which he can't express, which he won't express, an emotion in her. And that is the beginning of familiarity. They should never allow these words to come out of them. And if they do, the other should be allowed to correct the other and say, why did you say that? Because we are talking about a pervasive self on this earth. It is not an individual self, really, although we think it is, this unhappy self that ruins every life. It pervades everybody, more or less. And its job is to stay alive and to live off us. It's a parasite. It lives off the beauty of our life. And in doing that, it disturbs our life with thought and emotions and familiarity, and drives the love out of our partnership, if it possibly can. Because the self would much rather have an argument and pull each other apart, because the self, remember, is all the unhappiness that we have had since we were born. So the only thing the self can ever do in a situation is make it unhappy. So the self will be very happy about getting a promotion, very happy for a little while, excited, and will have a champagne dinner to celebrate it. And then it won't be long before the self is complaining about the long hours I have to work and how difficult it is. It'll start to complain about anything that it once enjoyed. It will start to complain about before long, because it is an unhappy, obsessive and pervasive entity that is in everybody, and it doesn't give up easily. So because it is myself, when it starts to die in me, or I start to detach from it and not give it its indulgence as I used to, I get the feeling that I'm dying. It literally comes across to me, I register as though I were dying. There it is, a part of me called myself, my past, that's dying. But the death doesn't go on forever, because you're always becoming more and more intelligent as your self dies, with all its wanting and its trying, its worry, its speculation, but its avoidance of the truth of love and life. As that starts to die, that impediment is demolished, you start to become more intelligent. You have a more authority in your life. You start to become the master of yourself instead of the slave of it to every emotion. You start to be the master. And that's a very wonderful thing, and of course that is the real spiritual life. Not what most religions talk about with their ceremonies, their terrible ceremonies which excite the psychic part of the being. The psychic part on the top, it gets excited by these psychic ceremonies and things, and doing this, and priests, terrible, terrible, disgraceful priests with the jewels in their hats and jewels on their fingers, when their master Jesus never wore anything apparently but a simple piece of cloth. And these imposters put on big hats and things and carry big golden staves, where if Jesus ever carried anything, it would have been a piece of wood off a tree or something. So we have this dreadful degradation of true religion, which always begins with the master. Now, if we were to look at Jesus, if such a man existed, but someone had to say the masterful things that he had to say. But he was a man, not God. For I am as much God as Jesus. And so are you when you realize God. When you realize God, you are one with God, and there's no division between you. And so he was able to say, I and the Father am one. Why not? That's our right. That's our where we started from, way, way back in the psyche. But only the master's words are true. No priest's words are true, because they haven't realized the truth. They just interpret what the master says, and it's always wrong. They always get it wrong, because they're unrealized. You can only listen to the words of the master if you can find them. We don't know how much of Jesus has been got at. There's a fair bit of rot in what he said, as well as a great deal of wealth in it. And then if we take Muhammad, we haven't got much of what Muhammad said except the Quran, but that's written down, that's recorded, you see. If you can only get the words of the master straight, you know, straight, no filling in, no things, because every master of his age is going to be conditioned by the limitations of his age compared with our broader perspective that we have now. You know, we have a global perspective of things, whereas Jesus was lucky to have had in his little region of the Jewish community there, just outside of it was the Greeks, the Greek influence, and just outside of that the Roman influence. But really, he was conditioned by his little community. And then the same would have happened to Muhammad, who had to fight many battles, you know. So he would be conditioned by that. But and as it comes to today, where I am, I have a wealth of knowledge of the global, having travelled the world and being able to read the media and various things, have a wide appreciation of things, so my conditioning would be different to theirs. And that's why I say I'm a master of the West, because I don't have Eastern teachings in me. Most teachers in the West always are referring to Eastern expressions and Eastern masters. I don't do that. I'm strictly down to earth, practical, you and me, in the bathroom, in the kitchen, in the bedroom, in the garden, everywhere where we live our practical life. That's where the truth has got to be found. The future of the human race as we know it depends on woman being loved. That's as we know it. But as we know it is going to gradually disappear, and love is going to become more and more an intellectual thing. It's going to become something, a technical thing. It's going to become where a man will devise ways of having virtual sex. He can devise that and have an orgasm with a virtual woman. That's not a real woman. That's the death of love between man and woman. And then we have more and more the emphasis on homosexuality. That is, man making love to man and woman making love with woman. Now that also is the death of love between man and woman. And the fact is, if we look at it, that only woman's body is made for man. And man is made only for woman's body. Anything else is a device to escape this extraordinary love between man and woman, which is so demanding. For it's much easier to love a woman for a woman than to love a man. And it's much easier for a man to love a man than to love a woman. The hardest thing on earth is for each to love the opposite gender and get through to God that way. But that's all going to disappear. And this cloning of the sheep, where they've cloned a sheep up in Scotland, and now I see that they've got human blood they're going to put into it. They're never going to stop, these scientists. Never. No matter what government regulations are imposed, these scientists never stop in their ignorance and the destruction of love. So eventually they will clone or make. It might be 100 years down the track. Might be a bit longer. Mightn't be that long. They will clone a woman, an artificial woman, and an artificial man. And they will make love, man will make love to an artificial woman. Because he doesn't. It's like going to a prostitute. The beauty of going to a prostitute for a man is he hands his money over. He doesn't have to love her. He doesn't have to woo her. He doesn't have to please her. He can just masturbate himself in her. And of course, she serves a great purpose on this earth. Because if man, and most of them are getting up to it, we don't hear half of what's going on. The prostitutes take the claw of sex out of so many men on this earth. For sex, as I say, is violence. And without these women taking it out of man in so many countries all over the world, there would be a great violence, a greater violence around the earth than there is now. And it's pretty bad now. And it will get bad, worse and worse. And it will get so bad in the future that we will have fortress societies where we will, I think something like an old movie there once, where we lock the baddies out because they're so bad and violent. This is way down the track. But it all comes from losing the fundamental love between man and woman, which is the fundamental love of existence. When you don't have the fundamental love of existence, you try to get out of existence. And you do that intellectually and technologically. And so this will not continue, the love between man and woman. But then it doesn't matter, does it? Because everybody dies and it all disappears. But it does matter to those who know God and love truth. And love the God that is woman and the God that is man in existence. Marriage is not necessarily necessary where I come from. It is a matter of what needs to be, whether I marry or don't marry. For everything is determined by life itself. But when man and woman determine things, making the decision to marry, it usually ends in disaster. So it is best to hand my life over to a power within me and allow that to direct my paths. And it might, when I meet a woman, I might marry her, but then I might not, depending on that will. But I still will love her, and she will know that she is loved. And that's the most important thing for a woman to know. I am loved. He loves me. And to me, what substitutes for marriage as a reality in our love together is the facing of the fact of why man and woman come together in partnership. Where I come from, man and woman come together in partnership to enjoy one another, to enjoy that partnership. As soon as that enjoyment starts to disappear from the partnership, then it is doomed. Oh, they may stay together for the children, they may stay together for the comfort and convenience, but it's doomed. They will start to grow apart. And that's tragic. To me, if I love you, then I enjoy being with you. And I will do all in my power to beware of myself, which will endeavour to destroy that in some way or other, as we find in all around us. Myself will always do something to destroy love or peace or rightness or goodness. Because, you see, it is made of pain and it rises up from within me to get into the love and harmony that I have with my partner. It rises up in her too. And as soon as pain comes into love, then it's no longer love. There's got an essence of pain in it. So we've got to be able to dissolve the self, to not allow it to enter our relationship. First of all, through my being, and then through your being, the woman's. You have to be as responsible as I have to be. Otherwise, ourselves are going to destroy our love that we had at the beginning. And that is a tragedy, and one that's repeated everywhere. If the love has disappeared because the self has come between, where I come from and in the people that I talk to at my meetings, I say, if that is so, then it's time you had an intelligent conversation. For few conversations that men and women have together are intelligent. Usually in situations where the self has come between them, they accuse each other of things. They blame each other of things. And they justify their own shortcomings or whatever it is. So they have a discussion like that, in which there's much blaming, much accusing, and much justifying of my stand. And I say to them, an intelligent conversation would be something like this. One of them would have to say, I can't live like this anymore. It is too destroying of my being and the pleasure of my existence, as I know it must be for you. So let us now decide what we can do. Let us do it willingly. Otherwise, I'm going to leave you. Then if it's an intelligent conversation, the man might say, well, what can we do that we haven't done? And if the woman had been to my meetings, you see, she would say, we can start being honest. And he might say, what do you mean by that? She says, we've got to start being honest to life. Not honest to each other, but honest to life. I, for instance, have to ask you, what am I doing to you or not doing to you that is making you unhappy and irritable? And I have to be able to hear your reply without reacting and getting emotional. I have to hear what you say. And you have to do the same thing. You have to be able to say to me, what am I doing that is making you unhappy or not doing and making you irritable and emotional? Because that's the point. That's what happens between the two. One is doing or not doing and making the other irritable or emotional. But we don't do that. Our modus operandi is to accuse the other. Look, there you go again. You're doing that again. You're doing that to me. I'm not doing anything to you. Well, yes, you are. And you're just blaming and justifying. What about you? You see, if I point out anything to you in this ignorant society and partnerships, if I point out anything that you're doing to me without an intelligent conversation having taken place first, the first reaction is for you to say, what about you? Yesterday you did so-and-so, you did so. So there's immediate reaction, no penetration, no wisdom, no self-realization where I realize what I have been doing or not doing. And I will do my best because I love you and I've always loved you. I will do my best to give this up or to change my ignorant way I have been treating you. Because I want to be true to life. And we are together to enjoy one another. And that's being true to life. But then when we start to enjoy each other's personalities or minds or things, it's a partial thing, and we start to get apart. I'm here to enjoy you, and as soon as I don't, I have to be very honest in my relationship and be prepared to leave as necessary if the other cannot listen or cannot be honest to what is needed between the two of us. Yes, sometimes you have to leave a partner, even though you've done much together and you've loved each other. This is life. We all have to leave each other in death. And sometimes, because we can't get it right, and because of the very nature of ourselves, we are forced to leave each other. Or one or the other has an affair or falls in love with another, someone else. These are things that are reality of life. And to my knowledge and experience, the best thing to guard against my woman leaving me is for me to love her rightly and truthfully, like honestly. That's the best thing. But if I can't love her, and if she can't love me, sometimes it's best to break apart anyway, because we've done all we can. We've had our intelligent conversations. We've endeavored to do everything to get rid of the familiarity between us. But it doesn't happen. So sometimes it's best to break apart. Even if you break apart for 3 weeks or 3 months, it's likely to bring one of us to our senses and make us realize what we love. But while we soldier on, making love that's not communicative when we do make love, living together out of comfort and convenience and to pay off the mortgage, we are then in a condition of human love, which is compromise love. So, but the only risk is that if we go apart for 3 weeks or 3 months, that one of the partners might be so free and find another lover, which will be much better than me for her. But that's life, isn't it? That's life. Women seem to want to be equal with men these days, that's true. But men and women are not equal. I mean, what does equal mean anyway? Men and women are not the same. They're completely different. And they want to be equal. Well, how can a woman be equal to a man when he has the physical power to smash her in the face and knock her down, which he doesn't have? How can she be equal with him? Does she want to be able to smash him in the face? Or is that a wrong desire to be equal to man? What she wants is to be the woman that she is, and for man to be the man that he is. And in those two principles, which are not trying to be like the other, there is truth and love and the realization of God in that. But they must be what they are. Now a woman is much more sensitive than man spiritually inside. She has a greater roundness of her. Emotions are more rounded and finer than his. Remember, she is the prize of existence. She is the mystery of existence. Man has got a coarser makeup because he's the doer. He's the pursuer. He's the one with the erection. You know, he's the one, he's the projector. So he's a coarser system than the woman. And he has to pursue the woman, and he has to woo her and win her for her to give him the beauty and the mystery, which is his for the taking once he can win her. But he can't win her through excitability or sex. She doesn't matter how much she would strive to open herself to give it to him. She can't. It's governed by life. And life says, you can't have it, man. The one thing that you want more than anything on earth, you can't have it. It only comes for love and self-denial. Then it comes from her. This equality of man and woman, this seeking that, has led to all sorts of putting woman in man's place, such as, and there's nothing wrong with it, I don't say anything's wrong, it's just the gradual degradation of woman and the love between man and woman, but women join the army. Now the first thing that's going to happen if they go to war is they're going to be raped. That is inevitable because of man's sexuality and lack of love. Now is that a good thing? Now we find that they're also getting raped in the navy ships of their own side because they're vulnerable to man's sexuality. Now is that good? And then they're in the police force having to kill, if necessary, or batten the skulls of men and women whom they have given birth to as woman. Is that good? Is it elevating of woman to do these things, or is it just a movement of the psyche that wants to leave woman behind and become a man, like a man? Now, feminism, where I come from, is purely a masculine reaction against not being loved. A woman's reaction through the masculinity that's being put in her. Instead of loving, she takes the male, that takes the male option of taking an action which is the opposite to what is required for her to love. So everything's a reaction, and it's to get away from having to love man or woman. That's where I come from. But as I say, it doesn't matter. We all die in the end. It doesn't matter, but does it matter? Is there a place inside of us? Is there an integrity that holds this world together with some other invisible world inside of us? Is love, which is so important here and being left behind, is that somehow communicate with something in an invisible place inside of us, another world, which perhaps is the world of death? Is it the lack of love that's going to repeat itself over and over for a million years perhaps in this formal sensory world? Is the lack of love going to make everybody who's born repeat the misery and more misery of lack of love that we have seen? Is that what reincarnation is about? Or where I come from, yes, that's what reincarnation is about. The only thing that reincarnates is ignorance, misery, wretchedness, and lack of love. That's what reincarnates. And it endeavours to get into our bodies as soon as we are born. And it does a pretty good job, doesn't it, as myself? And it ruins everything and will continue to do that. And so the next generation will have to behave with less prospect of making love and putting love first. Doesn't matter, but does it matter? Well, perhaps one day we'll find out. You see, our interest in the advances of science to put a man on the moon and now to put another vehicle on the moon is supposed to be a remarkable feat. It's supposed to be a remarkable achievement. Well, it might be, but it's not going to do your love or my love or our children's love the slightest bit of good. As a matter of fact, it's going to detract from it, because my children will get the wrong end of the stick about what life's about, and they will start to believe in science and all its nonsense about how wonderful these discoveries are, when there's no scientist on earth has ever discovered himself. So he doesn't know any truth at all. And all his theories are flawed. And what would he do if he landed on Mars and found some other life, which he will never do anyway, I'll tell you that now. But what would he do? He would transmit his anger, his guilt, his hatred of woman, and his love of sex. He would bring all that in to a new world of life. My God, what a prospect did the scientists ever do land there? What will they do? Are they going to go with their negative emotions? Of course they are, because they're not important to them. They think they're okay as long as they're discovering something new, instead of discovering something very old, which is their own obsession with negativity. Ask any scientist, how's your love life? You'll find out how much he knows then, how much Einstein's theory is helpful to him. Einstein's theory means nothing to you and me, nothing at all, and yet the whole world calls him a genius. Well, he might have been a genius in some respect of the blackboard and some other respect of how science makes the atoms or whatever it is they invent behave. But it doesn't do anything for you and me and the quality of our life. They might add comfort and convenience, but that's not what life's about. That's what living's about. Life is about love and honesty and truth and harmony and sweetness and rightness and firmness and the ability to have an authority that comes from a place inside which is not of any self. Yes, one of the, or two of the Eastern expressions that I don't use very often now, but I used to use it a lot. That doesn't mean it's not still the truth. Are the words Bhagavati and Bhagavat. This is from the Hindu religion. Bhagavati means God in female form, and Bhagavat means God in male form. And in the depths of that religion and that genius of that realization of what they mean is probably the same thing that I've been talking about here, the love of man for woman and the love of woman for man. But each is God. You see, God in the first instance is out of existence. It is the whole. Nobody can name it or describe it. It is just magnificent. That's all you can say. Or great, or beautiful, all those words. But in existence, as soon as God comes into existence, the existence bifurcates or reduces that God urge, that energy into a fork. Upside down. So there's one, the eternal one, the never-ending principle of God and life and truth and death and love. And as soon as it hits the human brain, it bifurcates into male and female. And that continues right through the existence of all species. But at the height of the species is man and woman. They represent all the other species because all the other species exist in each one of us. We are the culmination of the evolution of all the species. We contain everything that they had. And so we've got two of us. There's only you and me. Bhagavat, God. God concealed in woman's body. Behind the ignorance that she has accumulated, and God as man behind the ignorance that his body and system has accumulated. And the eternal endeavor of God is to make the man and the woman conscious of what is in their own bodies, this God, this truth, this being. That's what it is. But they will continue to go outward to put faith in scientific discoveries instead of discovering, going inward, shedding the impediments of emotion and excitability in the thinking mind, shedding that attachment to those things, and discovering bit by bit this extraordinary state of stillness and power, but not power over anything, but just pure, naked power inside of the divine. And that's what my teaching's about. So, Bhagavati, indeed I've even written a song about Bhagavat and Bhagavati. So deep was my realization of the love of woman and the love of man being God. Oh, my friend life, yes. Yes, I've wrote a song about my friend life too. As a matter of fact, I have a songs tape called The Songs of Barry Long, which were written many years ago when I was in the midst of the spirit entering this body and myself. And that song that I wrote when I was in public relations of all things is called My Friend Life. And the words are, and you'll notice the similarity to the words of this song to everything I've been speaking about. My friend life is death and birth. My friend life is the whole wide earth. My friend life is sorrow and a tear. But my friend life does not know fear. All the people would drag me down, but not while my friend life's around. My friend life is change and pain, but that's all part of my friend's game. Play the game, and it can be fun. Fight to win, and the fun's all done. The Bhagavati song goes, I can't sing it here, although I have an attempt on my tape. Bhagavati, Bhagavati, planted together by the eternal giver. Two willow trees dipped and sipped at the river of life. Neither in the shadow of the other, and yet both intermingled like wind that has met. Each one alone, though internally bound by the ground. Bhagavati, Bhagavati, when death, the compassionate giver, arrives, both fall in and die. I have another song called The Place of the Sinking Heart. All these songs are an expression of the spiritual life as I saw it, as I went through it. And I saw how thought brings about the pain in us from the past. And that goes like, the place of the sinking heart is the place of the thinking heart. And if you think, then you must drink at the place of the sinking heart. Your thought is but spawn of the past, caught on memory's treacherous cast. And if you think, then you must drink at the place of the sinking heart. I'd like to repeat one other song that I wrote so that everybody can see in their own experience whether this happens to be the truth. How do you write the story of a million years? How do you write the story of a river of tears? How do you write the story of eternity? how do you write the mystery of you and me? The whole worlds are groaning and travailing in agony, and weeping and fearing as it shuffles towards its destiny. How do you write the story of this tragic throng? How do you write? How do you write? How can you write what's wrong? Yes, people have asked me, what are you leaving behind? Well, it's true that I've written a number of books, which the masses, of course, will never buy until they lose someone they love or something like that. And I've left tapes behind, and all these contain this teaching which I'm speaking of now. But the finest thing that I shall leave behind in this existence is the men and women who are living my teaching and finding the freedom and beauty in that. Finding that they are an authority, that they are responsible for their self, and that they have changed their lives and changed the lives of even people around them. Bring them closer to a perception of truth, to a perception of love, to a perception of God, the Most High, the Most Intelligent Creator behind all existence. That's what I leave behind. That is living truth, living love, living people who will carry on what I have brought in. And I think that's the most wonderful gift that I have been able to present to the earth, the living people who have the taste of freedom and the taste of love and will never, ever forget.